Fire Billy. Fire Billy. No matter how dark the days in the future get, they will never be as dark as those days, and I am so glad that they are over. Thank you so much for joining us on the inaugural episode of the Nets Pulse podcast, part of the Pulse Podcast Network. I am your co-host, Brett Manbun Garofalo, accompanied by my esteemed co-host, Carl the Talent Jackson. Carl, how the hell are you?
I'm just taking a business decision with my lineup choices like the Nets did on Monday night. Brett, how you doing?
That was a tough one to watch.
Yeah, I solved that by just not watching it once I saw that they were going to sit Joe Harris. It was, you know, I was like, you know what, if we're going to phone it in, I'm gonna take the night off.
It's just so interesting the teams they decide to phone it in against versus the teams they don't. For example, they went all out in that Spurs game, even though they traveled with Mitch Creek and Theo Pinson. They came out, warmed up for 35 minutes before the game, sat on the bench, didn't see a minute of playing time. And then in the Bucks game, they're throwing Musa in there and asking him to run the offense.
Yeah, it was pretty wild. I mean, in fairness to Kenny, I mean, they almost won the Spurs game. They played him pretty well, and they looked a lot better in that game than they did against Orlando or Milwaukee. So I guess you gotta count that as well.
Totally. And we were going to start with introductions and a little bit of background about how we know each other, but there were a few pieces of Nets news between our dry run last night and the recording tonight that shook the sports media world to its core. Number one being Caris LeVert and Allen Crabbe being cleared for 5-on-5 practice, and Allen Crabbe even being upgraded to probable for the Nets game tomorrow night on Wednesday versus the Denver Nuggets. Carl, your thoughts?
I think you're being very charitable by including Allen Crabbe in that exciting news. No, I mean, listen, like, honestly, at this point, I think it will be good for them to get Crabbe back, just kind of given, you know, where things have been and with Dinwiddie being out. But in terms of Caris, I mean, it's really, really exciting. I mean, obviously, you know, you hope they're not rushing him back. I think, you know, I'm inclined to trust the medical staff that the Nets have, and you know, they don't really have a reason to rush him back. But honestly, could not come at a better time for where this team is at, given Dinwiddie's injury.
I completely agree. And I think a lot of people have been saying that getting Caris back gives us a second ball handler and takes some of the pressure off of D'Angelo Russell. But for me, it's getting a second creator out there, because Shabazz Napier is one of the best ball handlers in the league, in my opinion. I think that he keeps his dribble better than almost anybody. It's just that either A, he's not being told to look to create his own offense, or he simply can't bring himself to do that. And the frustrating thing for me is you can see it every once in a while. I mean, in the Orlando game, he called Jared Allen up into the wing and had a beautiful pick and roll play with him where Jared Allen drew a foul and I think had 1 out of 2 free throws, but he just doesn't do that enough, and it really puts a lot of pressure on D'Lo, and I don't want to say exposes him a little bit. I mean, the entire defense is focused on him, but it hasn't been the easiest thing from a viewing perspective.
Yeah, it certainly gets a little bit stagnant out there. He needs some more of his Stumptown coffee. I was just watching his Stumptown coffee commercial from Portland earlier today. In fact, like I actually feel like moving to Brooklyn like probably could have been a really good opportunity for him to continue that endorsement, because nobody does artisanal roasted beans like Brooklyn. But anyway, so you know, as you mentioned, you know, we're gonna hop into this. We got a bunch of stuff to talk about today. We got D'Lo's All-Star selection. We've got, you know, trade deadline rumors. We'll talk a little bit more about the recent games, and then we'll talk a little bit about trade deadline around the league, and obviously the big Knicks Porzingis trade and everything that's going on with the AD insanity. But first, I think since it's our inaugural episode, we just wanted to reintroduce ourselves a little bit.
Absolutely. You know, I have one more item continuing being the clown derailing us here, but I want to wish Rodions Kurucs a happy 21st birthday. That was another thing that the Twitterverse gifted me today. I saw that it was his birthday, and I was going to say, enjoy your first drink on me, but I think where he comes from, the drinking age is upon conception, so I'm sure he's far ahead of us.
12 in Latvia. I actually forgot about that. I learned that today from Spencer Dinwiddie on Twitter, so that's pretty awesome. And I will say, and this is getting ahead of ourselves again, but Spencer Dinwiddie tweeting through the pain meds has been real A on the unintentional comedy skill for sure.
He's one of my favorite follows, him and Jared Dudley.
Yeah.
But how do we know each other, Carl? I was going through what I wanted to say, and I really feel like there's nothing that I can say that won't make people absolutely hate me. I'm 5'11", white, 155 pounds, grew up in Greenwich, Connecticut, moved down to Austin, Texas to contribute to both the traffic and the rising rent problem. And I work in tech. I mean, there's really nothing else you can add besides I have a man bun.
Yeah, that's a pretty thorough biography there, Brett. You and I have known each other, I mean, almost our whole lives at this point. I think you're pretty much where I got my Nets fandom from, you and Brendan. So, you know, growing up around, you know, not in New Jersey, but with two of the only two diehard New Jersey Nets fans that I knew was pretty cool. I lived in Brooklyn. I was about a 10-minute walk from the Barclays Center. Kept my beard and my knit hat and moved up to Vermont, where I keep them unironically along with the red flannel. You know, try to get back down there every now and again, whenever possible.
Well, I think what I respect most about your Nets fandom is I started off with the Nets as a kid, and I grew up in a household where my father didn't discriminate between New York sports teams. His father had season tickets to the Knicks in the 70s, so he was present for both championships runs, but he also used to go to New Jersey to watch Dr. J play for the ABA Nets, and he told me he didn't need to get season tickets for them because they were always available for $21 or less, so it doesn't sound like much has changed with the Nets over the years. But we used to go to Nets games when I was a kid because they were cheaper, and they even had coach buses that would pick us up from town hall and give us popcorn, hot dogs. I got this awesome hat that I saw a kid wearing in one of the scenes in Wet Hot American Summer, which remains one of the top 15 moments of my life when I noticed that, and ended up being at the game where Stephon Marbury had his first triple double, and then they traded for Jason Kidd, went to back-to-back finals, and eventually got Vince Carter, and I was hooked.
Yeah, see, I decided to. I mean, I had been to some games at IZOD and at the Prudential Center, but you know, I really decided to jump on the bandwagon during, I believe it was the second Dwight Mayer, when they signed Joe Johnson and not Dwight Howard, and you know, decided that like, hey, this Joe Johnson character is such an exciting individual that I absolutely have to be involved. But since then, you know, went to the first game in Barclays Center, went to the makeup first game against the Knicks in Barclays Center. I have a Sean Kilpatrick bobblehead doll and Andre Blatch jersey, and I'm still a card carrying member of the Keith Bogans Roll Star Hip Hop Appreciation Society. So haven't been there quite as long, but I've certainly weathered the dark times. But now I feel like we're turning a corner.
You know, we really might be, and you bringing up Joe Johnson made me laugh because I was going through this the other night knowing that we were going to be talking about D'Angelo Russell's All-Star selection. Do you know who our last All-Star selection was?
Well, I mean, when you hide it so much in a setup like that, I have to guess Joe Johnson.
Yeah, it was, which is crazy to think about because he was over the hill when we traded for them. Even though I have no ill feelings towards his Nets tenure, he was one of the most exciting players to watch and gave us all those clutch shots.
I think he's been the best Brooklyn Net so far. I don't honestly think. I mean, well, Lopez, I suppose, maybe was better, but he's been up there. I enjoyed Joe, but don't forget about Spencer Dinwiddie's skills challenge win last year.
Oh, I will absolutely not forget that. that was the highlight of last year for me.
So how are we feeling about the All-Star selection? Are you excited that we're getting the recognition? Are you excited for D'Angelo that he's getting the recognition? Are you worried that it's going to, you know, hurt our ability to sign him in free agency? What are your thoughts?
When I was thinking about this, I posed it to myself as, does this screw us in free agency or does it not? Because I'm always thinking long-term about these things, which isn't the best. I should probably just enjoy the moment and enjoy that we have an All-Star for the first time since Joe Johnson. But for me, I really feel like Nets fans can sit back and enjoy this because, in my opinion, with D'Angelo Russell's marketability, his sizzle over steak game, we were screwed in free agency anyway. I think there's some team out there that that's going to throw him a huge contract, and the Nets are going to be forced to either match or pray that our culture and the fact that we've developed him into an all-star allows him to sit back and say, maybe this is the best decision for me basketball-wise and long-term to take less and be with the Nets. But I don't think this necessarily changes things in terms of our ability to sign him. I think somebody was throwing a contract at him regardless.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, I think once he got as close to the conversation as he did with this hot streak that he's been on, I mean, that was a little bit of a foregone conclusion. So I'm glad that he got recognized. Obviously not glad that, you know, he came in as an injury replacement, you know, huge loss for Oladipo there. But
let's not really argue over semantics here, you know.
Well, no, I'm not saying that he shouldn't have been the all-star, the injury replacement. I'm just, you know, bummed that Oladipo got hurt, because he's been awesome.
I will say I'm enjoying nothing more than Raptors fans being incredibly salty that Pascal Siakam didn't even get considered for the injury replacement, not for the all-star game.
Spicy P, who gave himself his own nickname. Yeah, I mean, listen, like, I love Pascal Siakam, and, you know, I think he's a great player, but he's definitely like a basketball fan's basketball player. Like, you know, I don't know that the All-Star game is really the proper venue to be recognizing his talents, honestly.
You should hear the arguments these Twitter Pascal Siakam stands are making. Well, I guess the All-Star game doesn't value defense.
Yeah, I think that's pretty known at this point.
Correct.
I mean, solid analysis. Sorry, was somebody arguing that?
Yeah, somebody. That was the argument for Pascal Siakam.
Yeah, that's pretty wild. I mean, I think the other thing about D'Angelo that has been really exciting is, like, you know, obviously we've seen him improve over the entire time that he's been here, and so that's exciting. And I still think that there's kind of room for him to continue improving. And if you look at kind of the trajectory that, you know, Spencer Dinwiddie has taken or Caris LeVert, like, I think, you know, with a little bit more time, you know, continuing with this team, like, he can still get better. But I think also, like, when you look at what he's done, just in terms of buying into the culture, buying into, you know, the program, as Kenny Atkinson and Sean Marks call it, like, he's been so incredibly coachable. The fact that, you know, we can talk about, you know, Kenny Atkinson's rotations and whether or not D'Angelo Russell should be playing at the ends of games or not. But the fact of the matter is that he has sat a lot of the time, but he has always been the first guy up off the bench. He's always been, like, you know, leading the high five line. When Kenny benched him a couple games ago, and, you know, the media was asking him about it, he was basically like, listen, I'm rolling with the guy that's gotten us here this whole time. And I, you know, I think that's shown, like, a ton of growth, and especially for somebody that, you know, came into the league really young, had, you know, some questionable moments, I think, during his time with the Lakers, got absolutely trashed by the Lakers on his way out the door, which I think, frankly, in retrospect, says a lot more about the Lakers than it does about D'Angelo Russell. But has really, you know, come into his own in this moment in Brooklyn is really cool. And, you know, Brian Lewis from the New York Post had a good article about him the other day. And one thing that stuck out to me was Kenny talking about how coachable he is and how much he craves coaching. And Kenny said, which is also, you know, mentioning the Lakers thing, he said, I didn't talk to Luke or anybody with the Lakers, but he talked to Thad Matta from Ohio State. And Thad said, you got to coach him. He wants to be coached. You got to get at him directly. And he really respects that. And I think that, you know, it's a real testament to kind of everything that the Nets are building to see how bought in, you know, D'Angelo Russell is and, you know, amongst all this group of guys that they have, everybody's so bought in.
I'm really glad that you said that, because I read a quote from Kenny the other day where he said, I think we've coached D'Angelo Russell harder than we've ever coached any other player, not only with the Nets, but in my entire tenure as a coach. So clearly he took that advice from Thad Matta to heart. If you haven't already, I would highly suggest watching the about 5-minute clip of D'Angelo Russell on ESPN today. It's Mike and Jalen interviewing him, and they get right into it. The first question is about the time and effort he's put into the Nets and how he balances that with all of the trade rumors and the fact that despite becoming an all-star and leading the team in scoring, he still might and could be traded at any time. And he handles all of the questions with a level of maturity that I've never seen from him. All he does is thank the Nets organization, talk about how long long it took him to mature in the business and understand that things can and will happen at any time, and just to take it day by day. And it did, while it did seem a little bit canned, it was a little bit better than the typical, you can tell the player's emotional about it and annoyed that they're being asked the question. He's just at peace with all of it, which I really appreciated. Also, I don't think that it's any coincidence that with D'Angelo Russell's All-Star selection comes the Nets' first national TV slot of the year. March 13th, 2019, Nets versus Thunder has unceremoniously ousted the Heat Pistons game on that night. This is unprecedented. I cannot remember the last time that we actually had a national TV game. I'm so excited. And it might coincide with all of our players, or at least our best players, being back and being healthy. So this could be a good showing for the Nets.
And getting flexed into prime time, baby.
It's huge. And one last point that I wanted to make at the beginning of this podcast, we wished Rodians a happy 21st birthday. It still blows my mind that D'Angelo Russell is only 22 years old with the time that he's been in the league and the improvement that he's shown, not only physically, but mentally as well.
Yeah, that's pretty outrageous, frankly. And, you know, like in that same article I was talking about, they had all these quotes from his high school coach, and I'm like, oh, like, you know, why are they getting quotes from his high school coach? I'm like, he's in high school like 3 years ago, or four or whatever. Like, you know, he was 1 year at Ohio State. He's been in the league. And he's always been young, because he and LeVert, I think, were rookies the same year. Is that right?
Yes.
I believe they were, but LeVert is like a year older than him. So, you know, he is always one of these guys when I'm looking down at the sheet. Him and Allen as well. Allen is super young, too. But I'm always like, hey, like, you know, these guys are younger than I thought they were. And, you know, I looked a little bit, and we can, you know, later on in the season, or as we head into the offseason, we talk about, you know, what's going to happen in free agency with him. You know, I did a little bit of a deep dive just on kind of his shot chart, his shot area, because, like, there is, you know, when I watch him play, like, I've been floored by his shooting ability, his ability to take over games, his ability to you know, just pour it in on certain nights. I mean, the Kings game is one that jumps immediately to mind, where he just, you know, had a flamethrower out there. But then, you know, you see other games like what you were talking about before, where it's like him and Shabazz trying to run the offense against Orlando. And I think Orlando was kind of a big team letdown game overall, but like, there's definitely times where things stagnate and you hear the criticism of him, just that, like, you know, he's shooting three so well, he's got a really strong mid-range game, but obviously mid-range game isn't as beneficial, you know, analytically, as other things. And it was just kind of like looking for different patterns to kind of come out. I mean, he definitely doesn't get to the restricted area as much as somebody like Spencer Dinwiddie. So that's one thing to work on. But, you know, when I was looking at that and I was thinking about it, I feel like Dinwiddie's has improved so much just this year at getting to the basket, in, you know, a much later year for him being in the league. And I think that that's an area that, you know, they can continue to work with D'Angelo on. You know, he's able to create his own shot. He's able to get separation and get the shot off. And you know, that kind of leaves him as this kind of streaky guy sometimes, where, you know, when it's falling, he's great. When it's not, you know, he struggles a little bit. But I think being able to get to the rim a little bit more consistently and being able to play with contact a little bit more is going to be really helpful.
And this is purely anecdotal, and it's going to sound like I'm one of those anti-stats basketball analysts, but I truly feel like the lack of ability to get to the rim whenever he wants takes away from his, again, I'm going to say, ability to say, I'm going to take over this game and I'm going to not let the Nets lose it. I feel like it's not completely in his control down the stretch like it is with the Spencer and Dinwiddie, where you feel confident with Spencer in the game that he's going to slow it down, at least get some free throws or get somebody a good shot. Whereas if D'Angelo Russell's shot isn't falling, you could see a shot that's too early in the shot clock, or you could see a bad turnover because he can't get all the way to the rim and is looking for a bailout. And I think that really hurts him in crunch time, which is why we've seen him sit over Spencer Dinwiddie down the stretch before Dinwiddie went down. And again, this is purely anecdotal things that I'm bringing up, but one thing that I've noticed about him is he's got the skinniest legs of any player his size that I have ever seen. I don't think he has calf muscles. I don't think that they exist. It's bizarre. And once you see it, you won't be able to unnotice it, especially if you go to the games, it becomes even more apparent. Also, beyond that, when he's warming up before games, it's very, very clear that he is aware that he can't get to the rim. He knows exactly where he can get, and he practices those shots. In fact, usually when he's out there warming up, the first 15 to 20 minutes of the game, he's only practicing those one-handed off-balance floaters in the lane, because that's where he's confident he can at least get to and then get a shot off before the defense catches up to him.
Yeah. Well, I mean, just looking at his numbers, I was just on, stats.nba.com, just looking at, 14 of his attempts come in the restricted area compared to like 19 for Dinwiddie. And then 41 are coming from kind of either mid-range or like floater range, like in the paint, but a non-restricted area. And I think that's exactly right. Like he gets to those spots, he kind of pulls up. And I mean, to be perfectly honest with you, he's knocked a lot of them down. He's very good at that. So it's almost like he's too successful with that, you know, that kind of pulls his shot profile to be something that's a little bit less than what you'd like. But at the same time, if it's working for him, good on him, you know?
And that's got to be tough for a player to understand, because when you're in the game, you probably can't feel the impact of how much more you affected the game by slowing it down, getting to the line, giving your defense an opportunity to breathe and reset, and the team to think about, okay, where do I need to be? How did that guy beat me on the last play? The next time that we're down the floor, I'm going to be a little bit less winded, but also give him a chance to collect himself as well. And like you said, he's incredibly good at those shots, and so he probably doesn't see a need to change. And really, this might be a moot point with LeVert and D'Lo and Dinwiddie all healthy, but when the offense relies on him, and even when it's just Russell and Dinwiddie out there, those flaws become a little bit more apparent. And one thing that I wanted to point out as well is an article that I read about 30 minutes before I hopped on it. Again, this is Twitter gifting me, but apparently Porzingis felt okay and almost desired a trade to the Nets as part of the teams that he greenlit once he knew that it wasn't going to work out with the Knicks. And I truly believe that watching what happened with D'Angelo Russell, us willing to embrace his quote unquote, whether these existed or not, personality issues, coach him as hard as we did, embrace him and turn him into an all-star, was something that influenced that decision and influenced Porzingis' openness to being traded to the Nets and maybe even Jimmy Butler earlier in the season. So you can't necessarily put a price tag on some of these accolades, even though they don't necessarily mean anything in the win-loss column.
Yeah, I mean, they're certainly winning the PR game, I think. And I think it's also like worth pointing out too that like referring to those personality issues, you know, whenever Kenny Atkinson's been asked about them, he's just flat out said. And I feel like he's not the kind of person that would sugarcoat something or not really. I mean, he's a pretty blunt dude. He's basically flat out been like, no, there weren't any. That was all fabricated. Like, you know, essentially being like, that wasn't an issue. Like, you know, we've coached him up and you know, he'll be hard on him about, you know, coaching things and on-court things. But, you know, I think they definitely get kind of the accolades for being transparent as an organization and just kind of being no BS about stuff too.
Yeah.
Because it was funny too. Sorry. One last thing. It was funny when they were on, forget which list it was. I think it was when they were on one of Porzingis's lists, and Matt Moore on Twitter was like, these are all the organizations that are in the city are organizations that don't leak. And that's where we're one of those, which I think, you know, given everything that we've seen this past week is definitely a notable thing.
For sure. And one more point about how we were screwed in free agency anyway. D'Angelo Russell leads us in jersey sales. He leads us in social media follows. I mean, we were doomed from the start here, and this is only going to increase a lead that he already had over a lot of our other players going to free agency.
Yeah, well, and one of those quotes from that article that I mentioned before, too, was Kevin Boyle, who is his coach at Monteverde Academy in Florida, saying he can be the new face of New York basketball. D'Angelo has the potential to fill that void. So, you know, I think he wants it. He's been aware of it. And, you know, I'm happy to go along for the ride if that's where we want to go.
I am too. I mean, it'll be tough for me to swallow giving him a max contract in the offseason. And quite frankly, I don't think that's what it's going to take to bring him back. But I do think what it's going to take will probably hinder our cap flexibility in a way that may prevent us from being a contender moving forward, which I am assuming is the goal. Although when you hear all of these Tobias Harris rumors, maybe it isn't the goal.
You hate that Tobias Harris?
No, I actually just watched the entire second half of Clippers Hornets to scout him a little bit because it sounded like we might end up with him in the offseason.
Cool, cool. All right, well, we can talk a little bit more about that and some of the things you mentioned, the Porzingis and everything else in a little bit. But did want to just touch on, you know, some of the recent games. I know you were in San Antonio with the Bats. And the Coyote earlier or last week, I guess. So you want to talk a little bit about that experience or other experiences you've had in San Antonio with the Nets?
For sure. So, you know, as I mentioned, I live in Austin, Texas, and I'll try not to bore everybody with too many backstories about the Nets. But the first Nets Spurs game that I attended was on Saturday, December 10th in 2016, which we lost by 29 points to nobody's surprise, pretty indicative of where the franchise was at the time. And Carl, actually, before I dive into that story, I will Venmo you $50 during this podcast recording if you can name 3 out of 5 starters from that day.
From 2016?
December 10th, 2016.
Oh boy. Okay. So that was the 16-17 season. That was Kenny's first season. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. So was that was the year that we had Sean Kilpatrick, Brooke Lopez, Trevor Booker, well, I'm gonna hedge and throw Justin Hamilton in there just because I think he's a hilarious individual. And who else? Was Joe Johnson was still on that team?
Joe Johnson was not on the team, but your first three nailed it. Booker, Lopez, sick. And Kilpatrick all started that game.
Perfect.
Your other two Nets starters for the day? Brett Garofalo favorite, Bojan Bogdanović.
Oh, man, Bojan. And, you know, Bojan, who led to the pick that became – no, he did not lead to the pick that became LeVert. That was Thad Young. But that was the trade with the Wizards was what we got for Bojan, right?
He led to Jared Allen, I believe.
That's right. Okay, that's right.
Which is wild.
Yeah. Awesome.
Wild to think about. And your last starter is Brooklyn favorite Isaiah Whitehead.
The Cyclone.
I cannot believe that Isaiah spin move Whitehead was a starter for that many games that season. I should look up how many games that he started, but it was way too many. Some other notables from that game, since you brought up Justin Hamilton, the only thing it says in the box score for him is not with team.
due to talent reasons,
which I found incredible.
He's busy frosting his tips.
He was brushing up on his German or wherever he's playing now. A couple other notable things from the game: the only player with a positive raw plus minus for the game, Luis Scola, who put up 15 and 11 in 15 minutes and hit three.
Luis Scola played for the Nets for about 25 minutes, like for the entire season. But I still remember that there's an amazing profile of him written when he moved to Brooklyn and lived in Brooklyn. Cause I think that was the first year they opened the training center. So like, you know, prior to that, everybody lived in Jersey still anyway, and then just commuted in for the games. But he was buying a place in like Carroll Gardens, or he renting a place in Carroll Gardens, and he like couldn't find anywhere to park his car. And I was like, this is so eminently relatable. I love this. Luis Scola, fantastic.
God, I love Luis Scola. I wish we got him when he was younger, but alas. Also getting minutes for the Nets, Randy game winner against Charlotte Foy. Never forget. One of the only highlights
the
of the season.
Boy era out of my mind. I do remember that game winner though. Oh man, I forgot about Randy Foy. Jeez.
Oh man, as a Boston College fan, being defeated in overtime in the Sweet 16, I have also blocked many Randy Foy memories out of my mind. But we do not need to get into that on this podcast.
Dude,
even
I
though
remember
Jared
when
Dudley.
I mean, this is just completely indulgent, but the three guards teams at Villanova with Foy, Alan Ray, and Kyle Lowry were pretty formidable. And I remember going to the Big East tournament game where Alan Ray got his eye poked out of his face, and it was pretty gnarly.
And it was gruesome. And I think it's pretty wild that Kyle Lowry ended up becoming the player with the most longevity and the best player out of those three, too. I think everybody.
By a mile.
Yeah, not even close. He was considered more of a utility junkyard dog when he came out of college.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I would have thought that it was going to be Mike. I like to party with Nardi, but you know, can't win them all. Dante Cunningham was on those teams too. Anyway, we're way off topic.
We're way off. I will give one more highlight of that game, which ended up being the best part about it. This was the game when Caris LeVert scored his first ever NBA points. He was 1 for 5 from the field, and he hit a reverse layup on a backdoor cut pass from net folk hero Brook Lopez.
That's awesome. That's pretty cool to say that you were at the game where Caris LeVert scored his first basket. I remember him then. He was like kind of spastic, but just like so slippery and smooth in a way too. It was just like all elbows and knees coming at you, but somehow it was like wriggling through all the cracks.
It was, and the shot looked good, but wasn't going in. And I think that was one of the most frustrating things. And you're thinking, okay, is this just going to be another Wes Johnson-esque player where everything he does looks great, but none of it works? And luckily, it didn't turn out that way. But I remember making a note of that being his first NBA points during that game, because those are the straws that we were grasping at that season. There was nothing else to cheer for. And like, oh, Caris LeVert, this guy that I didn't really know much about coming out of college, had a ton of injury history, and sounds like the Nets took a chance on him. Cool, he scored his first NBA points, and look at us now. He probably would have been most improved player had he not got down with that gruesome injury, which it sounds like he's coming back from very soon.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, no, it's very exciting. I will just throw out the plug that I miss Trevor Booker, though. He was fantastic.
Perennial entrepreneur Trevor Booker. did you ever read those articles where he was working with multiple venture capital firms, and not only was making investments himself off of the smaller contracts that he got, but he was teaching the other young players how to think about their money and make investments over time, so even if they didn't get larger contracts, they were still set up for success financially once they got out of the NBA?
I did not read those articles, but that sounds fantastic. Good for him.
Another example of a player that looks a lot like LeBron when he's running up the court, but can do none of the things that LeBron does.
Yeah. Wait, were these good investments?
I'm hoping that some of them were.
All right, cool.
Anyway, I'll give a couple more anecdotes on my trips to San Antonio, just because I think it's worth it for anybody that ever goes to a Spurs game. Luckily and by chance stumbled upon the hotel that the Brooklyn Nets stay at before games. There's an area in San Antonio called Pearl Brewery, which isn't a brewery now, but used to be. So it can be very confusing. They kept a lot of the old brewery equipment around and built a boutique hotel around it, an underground jazz club, a couple places that are artisan bakeries, coffee shops, apartment complexes. It's one of only two cool spots to hang out in San Antonio besides the Riverwalk. So I was down there with my buddy that I was going to the game with, who's a huge Spurs fan. We went inside Hotel Emma. I was showing him it for the first time, and all of a sudden a coach bus pulls up. And as we're standing there, I'm wearing a bright blue Petrovic jersey. The assistant coaches and the Nets players start walking out 10 feet in front of me to the bus. So I get to see Brook Lopez, Caris LeVert, all of these guys 5 feet from me walking out. And I'm the only Nets fan there, as you can imagine. I might be the only Nets fan in Texas to this day, who knows. But I went out and started cheering and was clapping as the bus pulled away and got some nods from the players. And that was definitely one of my favorite moments as a fan. So I remembered that for this latest Nets Spurs game that I went down to, and got permission to leave work early, drove down there and posted up again in the lobby of Hotel Emma, this time being a little bit more incognito, no more bright blue retro jersey. I was wearing a black Brooklyn hoodie and a long sleeve underneath it. And my sister was wearing a Brooklyn t-shirt. She was with me. We were so incognito and blending in because last time we thought we were going to kicked out if my buddy's daughter wasn't with us, that one of the trainers, once the coach bus pulled up this time, came out and asked us if we were part of Mitch's crew, which again, top 15 moment of my life. Both of them involved Mets Spurs. I don't know what that says about me, but I had to tell them that we were just fans. But we got to see all the assistant coaches up close, Jordan Ott, Brett Breilmeyer. We got to see Damari Carroll wearing a leather jacket with a skin tight pink hoodie underneath that leather jacket. We got to see Alan Williams with his hair in the non dreadlock man bun wearing an antisocial social club jacket. And it was really interesting to see which players were walking down to the bus with each other. For example, Ed Davis and Jared Allen seemed inseparable. They were joking, talking with each other. D'Angelo Russell didn't seem like he was in his own world, but came down by himself, as did Damari Carroll, who looked like he had just come back for a run before the game as well, before coming out and shooting around for 45 minutes. And this is a lot of talking. I apologize, but this is a gift from my team at work for end of year. They also got me courtside experience. So we got to show up to the game early, walk in and walk down to the courtside seats and watch both teams warm up. Got to listen to an assistant coach from the Spurs come over, talk to people that he knew, and give a lot of praise to the Brooklyn Nets, talking about our record over the past 24 games, saying that they wish that they had that record, and talking about what we've done in Brooklyn, and watching what the players did when they warmed up, which I found particularly intriguing. That's where I got all those anecdotes about D'Angelo Russell looking like he's walking on stilts rather than legs and only practicing those floaters because nobody else practiced those. It was very interesting to see how Ed Davis only practiced backdoor cuts and free throws, which I think is super important because if you look at the advanced stats, he's one of our best players, but he can't be out there at the end of games because he's a liability at the free throw line. They'd foul him every time. So if he's practicing free throws every day, maybe he's working himself up to a point where we can rely on him at the end of games. A couple other things that I noticed: Trevion Graham, who I love on defense and want to change the channel when he's on offense, only practiced threes, so thank the Lord. They had Jared Allen practicing passes and backdoor cuts. They had him at the top of the key practicing one-hand cross-court passes to the corner over and over again. He was okay at those. One pass, he almost took Theo Pinson's head off on the bench, who was looking at one of the assistant coaches' laptops. So we need a little bit more practice there, but it's very interesting that those are the things that they had Jared Allen practicing in addition to the three-pointer that everybody else on the team was shooting. So those are some of my initial thoughts and reactions from the game and being there courtside, which was an awesome experience. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, because I could talk about this for hours.
Well, two thoughts. One is it sounds a little bit more glamorous than the courtside experience that I had at the Izod Center, where we Brennan and I bought tickets to sit down there for like $40 the year after LeBron left the Cavs, and we were treated to a fantastic spread of just the saddest, I believe it was marketed as jambalaya in the entire world. That was just basically rice and cut up hot dog. So, you know, all the best at the Izod Center for sure. But I mean, I think, you know, watching Jared Allen grow, I think is really been pretty exciting over the past couple of years. I think, you know, big men and, you know, being a skilled big man in the league, like there's a little bit of a longer and a different kind of learning curve than there is for ball handlers and guards. And so, you know, to see him, you know, practicing passing and you know, getting better at different things like that. I mean, I think there's a lot of evolution left in his game. You know, whether it's becoming more of a fulcrum of the offense in addition to just being the role man or, you know, getting a little bit better at the corner three. I believe you're also 2-for-2 on Jared Allen corner threes in your Nets fandom career, which is like, you know, that doesn't need to hit it at more than like a 30, you know, percent clip. But if he could add that to the arsenal just so that he has to get, you know, tagged out there, like that's a huge deal.
I completely agree. And none of that to me is better than him discovering the ninja headband over the regular sweatband. I will never get over how awesome he looks with the fro and the headband on. But yeah, I feel hashtag blessed for being at only two Nets games this year. And in both games, Jared Allen didn't even touch the rim on corner threes. So that was great to see for sure. And I think he wanted to show out a little bit. He went to UT. He's got family in Texas.
Austin kid, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Both starting centers in that game went to the University of Texas, and he is from the area.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah, because LaMarcus Aldridge was there as well. All right. So I don't really think we need to spend too much time on the Orlando game or the Bucks game. I think frankly we could probably skip over them and go plow right into the trade deadline. So you know, just thinking about it from the Nets' perspective, we've seen a lot of different stuff going on, you know, around the league. But Brett, do you feel like the Nets are going to be buyers or sellers at the trade deadline? And that's not a binary question because the answer could be neither. What's your thought?
This is a way of answering your question with not answering. I think that we want to be buyers, but I think that what we're going to have to give up to get what we want, which is somebody to upgrade the four spot, is not – that trade isn't going to be available for us. I think that a lot of the players that are out there, teams are going to want a player and a pick for them, or at least a pick that the Nets aren't going to be willing to give up because we just got ourselves back in position to have assets for the future. And if we're going to give up picks, I think we want to do that in an all-in-one shot for somebody that can make an impact on bringing us from mediocrity to contention versus making us a little bit more shored up for a playoff run this season. Now, that being said, if there is a trade out there where we don't have to necessarily give up an asset to get somebody that we think we can improve the team with, then yeah, I think that we'll make it. But I was thinking through a lot of scenarios and I couldn't necessarily come up with one. Now, I'm obviously not Sean Marks. I didn't dig us out of a cave that was blocked by a rock and a Mack truck and had some steel with some screws that were soldered onto it and that had some dinosaur bones in there or whatever it is. But I just couldn't think, I couldn't think of any trades that didn't involve us having to give up some sort of asset on our end to upgrade at the four spot.
So a couple things to throw at you then. So agree that the four spot is the place to upgrade this team. I think obviously, you know, you still want to get Rodion's minutes, but I think, you know, it's taking some of the minutes that have gone to Dudley, a little bit maybe from Damari, and certainly a bunch from Rondé, who I love, but I think, you know, there's significant upgrade potential there. And also, you know, Trevion Graham as well, I think is the clear place for this team to upgrade both for the stretch run and for the future. So a couple ideas that were thrown out this week that I kind of found. Number one, I don't know if you caught it on the Brooklyn game. They were advocating for Carmelo Anthony.
Don't you say it.
I just picture a single solitary tear going down Devin's cheek. Somewhere somebody responded to them on Twitter and was like, Devin Grapersian is rolling over in his grave right now. but you know, I read the article and it's actually like pretty on point in setting up why there's a need to upgrade the four. I didn't understand the line from that to then like, oh, Carmelo Anthony, you know, which, you know, would be great if he could be Olympic Mellow, but you know, it'd be great if he could be current day Steph Curry too, but he's not going to be. So
I got a question for you. Is Carmelo Anthony better than Jared Dudley at this point?
Just looking at the numbers, right? Like, I think he might be just purely from a basketball sense, like on court type numbers, but I don't think he could fit into the offense. I don't think he could accept the role that Dudley's accepted. To say nothing of the locker room aspect of it. I mean, he's also not going to come here, right? But to say nothing of the locker room aspect of it, like, I just don't think he would be able to accept the role on the court that Dudley's played. But one idea that did seem kind of interesting to me, and this was from the Hardwood Knox podcast. So they basically were just going through every single team and throwing out like potential deals. And I don't know that this is enough to get this done, but they were like, you know, if you could target somebody that would help you for the stretch run, but would also, you could also get their bird rights so that, you know, either we could re-sign them in free agency kind of right off the bat, or if we want to shop and explore other options, we've still kind of got that on the back burner. So they were suggesting targeting Nikola Mirotic. The trade they threw out there, which I would take in a heartbeat, was Rondé, Jared Dudley's expiring, and the 2021 Knicks pick, second round pick that we have, which I would do. I just don't think that that's going to be enough to get Mirotić. But what do you think?
I don't think so either. Mirotić was one of the players that I thought of first because he fits in perfectly. He's a smart player. He makes good passes. He can nail shots from 5-6 feet behind the three-point arc. He can hit 4, 5, 6 threes in a game. That's exactly the type of player that fits well into Kenny's system. I feel like New Orleans might accept that package if they get the poo-poo platter they're asking for Anthony Davis. So I would say it's contingent. If they get 3 or 4 first-round picks from a desperate team, cough the Lakers, cough, then I think they'd be more than willing to accept a second-round pick and a couple, an expiring and another expiring young asset for Nikola Mirotić to clear the books and set themselves up for the future. But as it stands right now, if they can't get rid of AD at the deadline, they're probably going to want a first-round pick or a better player for Nikola.
Would you throw the Nuggets pick in? Something like that? Like,
how many years does Mirotić have left on his contract?
He is none. I mean, it's an expiring deal this year.
He is an expiring deal. Rights. Okay.
But you'd get his bird rights, and he makes, you know, $12.5 million. So, you know, you could, he would be in the neighborhood. I mean, I think he would represent a significant upgrade at that position that you could get on a somewhat cost-effective deal that, you know, you could have an inside track on.
For sure. And we can get him for way cheaper than what we would probably spend on somebody like a Tobias Harris I don't want to be too fatalistic here, but if we inevitably strike out on the major free agents during the offseason, I might do that now that you put it that way, because I think that we could sign him for significantly cheaper. I'm going to bank on not necessarily the culture from the outside, but once you're with the Nets organization, wanting to stay with them and re-sign with them because they take care of you. And you can see all the injuries that he's had since going to a team like New Orleans. I'm not going to blame that all on their staff, because, hey, to your point that we were talking about earlier, we've had a lot of injuries. Now, they've been freak injuries, but we've also had a lot of injuries, and we take care of our players minutes-wise, facilities-wise, medical staff-wise.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I mean, the injuries are definitely a looming piece of it. But I think it gives you some nice flexibility. The other thing that I thought of, kind of in that same vein, and it sounds like you're probably not going to like this one, but so I was listening to the Low Post, and he had Zach and Kevin Arnovitz on, and they were talking about the deadline. And, you know, he mentioned something which I had kind of forgotten about, which is that the Clippers – their pick this year to the Celtics, but it's lottery protected. So, like, in addition to the West being sort of generally crowded, in addition to their dreams this summer to go after Kawhi and go after some of the other big name free agents, I think they've been a rumored KD destination, although it sounds like the Knicks are the clear front runner there. You know, there just isn't a ton of incentive for them to, like, be the eighth seed. So might it make sense for them to start flipping some of their guys? And if you think that Tobias Harris is not going to be with the team next year, do you flip him and try to get something out of it? And then I think from the Nets perspective, do you put yourself in that same position? If you figure that he's somebody you're going to target in the offseason, obviously wouldn't be as cost effective as a Mirotić, but you could get the, you know, get his bird rights by, you know, putting a package together. I don't know what we'd have to get up to get him. You know, if that would include like a Joe Harris, then it's probably off the table. But if like Damari's expiring and the Nuggets pick and something else, you know, might be worth considering.
Yeah, and that is something that you could definitely see Jerry West doing as well. He clearly is focused on getting the teams that he runs to championship contention and isn't necessarily content with competing, but not being able to get there, being one of those Nate Robinson Bulls-esque teams that tries really hard during the regular season, runs their players into the ground. I'm just crapping all over Tom Thibodeau right now, and then gets into the playoffs and can't do anything because they're all exhausted, whereas the best teams are the ones that limit their players' minutes and then up their game 25% by playing their best lineups in the playoffs. So that I would really like, being able to get Tobias Harris now with time to sell him on the Nets system and the Nets culture. Watching him tonight, he takes incredibly inefficient shots in the Clippers offense. There were a lot of off the dribble turnaround fadeaway twos, which to his credit, he was making. If he was in the Nets system, he would be taking open threes. He would be driving to the basket. I really think that we could see, I don't want to say a Steve Nash-esque jump when he moved from the Mavs to the Suns, but I really think that we could maximize his efficiency and make him a perennial all-star if he was on the team. And if he got a taste of that during the second half of the season, I think that we really would be able to sign him for a little bit less than it will take in the offseason when he doesn't have any emotional ties relationships or positive value to tie to the Nets. So I think that I would be willing to do that to get him with time to sell him on our culture and our coaching staff's ability to get the most out of him.
Yeah, it's an interesting gambit. I mean, I don't know that he's going to turn down the max from somebody else if it's getting offered to him, but maybe he would. I don't know.
That is true because he gave up signing a larger contract in the offseason. Supposedly because he wanted to see if he could get an even bigger contract or a max contract this offseason. So if he already made that bet on himself and he's set up to get that, it would take a lot to change that mindset. So you're right. That's probably not realistic.
Yeah. I don't know. I think of the two, I think the Mirotić trade is a little bit more realistic, although I think you're going to get a, you know, last call at the bar, 2 a.m., everybody find somebody to love thing with him because he's very available. And, you know, we're going to run out of time. Like, everybody's paying attention to the AD saga. Like, we're going to run out of time, and they're going to try to flip him either way. So I'm not sure that we'd be able to get that deal done, but I think it's definitely something that I'd be interested in.
Do you think we go the opposite way and we – everybody tampers. So we know that we don't have any stars coming this summer, for example. But I'm not saying this is the case because I'm less plugged in than somebody that doesn't even follow the league. But what if we go and try to take on salary to get assets again and almost reload, knowing that we're not going to get any stars and we're not necessarily content with moving up from 6-8 to 5-3 in the East, and we look to take on something like a Danilo Gallinari's contract, who is somebody that could help the Nets at the four spot, but is getting paid $22 million in the 2019-2020 season.
I mean, I think it could work. I mean, I think that, I mean, obviously it was a slightly different situation, but I feel like that worked out really well with Amari Carroll, where, you know, they got the pick and the pick ironically ended up being Kyle Kuzma, but not for the Nets, but, you know, basically getting paid a pick to take him. And then he has been actually a plus contributor to the team, you know, for the last 2 years. And I think that was something that we looked at, you know, when that happened, where it was like, hey, sometimes the salary dump is just a pure salary dump. And sometimes it's like, okay, here's a guy that you're going to pay a little bit more than you'd want to for. But if you have the balance sheet to do it, then by all means, go for it. And he's still a quality player.
And I mean, that would tell me the management is still as realistic about the team as I am right now, whereas we're in a really good spot, but the levers that we can pull to get us to championship contention, which should ultimately be the goal, are very, very tough to see right now and are fairly complex, where it might be better to reload a little bit, recognize that we're not going to get there this summer, and see if we can pick up some assets that get us some more young players to build that foundation and build up enough assets so that the next time somebody like an Anthony Davis becomes available, the Nets have that credibility, we're on their list, and we have a better package than anybody can offer, which we don't have right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's interesting. I think I don't 100%. I don't know that the approach that they're taking is one of like, let's build up enough assets to like cash them in on a superstar, as much as it's like, let's, you know, build up players that fit together and then, you know, find somebody that we can kind of plug in over the top. I sort of feel like the way that the Nets are kind of looking right now, they'll be the kind of team that's going to plug one star in on an existing base and kind of supercharge it, as opposed to kind of clearing the decks and trying to get multiple stars to land there. But that's just my opinion.
No, I think that's fair. I mean, you've always brought up the point that the Nets' superpower is player development. And that always gets me thinking whether it was a chicken or an egg type of situation. I think that's what we had to do to be somewhat successful with the terrible hand that this regime, the Sean Marks regime, was dealt. Now that we have our picks moving forward and we have a base of young players, I'm wondering if they're going to adapt and pivot to what's available and what players are willing to come to the Nets bets, if any, and potentially change their strategy, or if they're going to stay the course. And that doesn't obviously mean they're going to ditch player development, but maybe if accumulating assets is the inefficiency in the market this year, with having to trade more than a few assets than you're willing to for even mediocre fours that potentially stretch the floor, maybe that's something that they pivot to. I'm just throwing it out there. This Nets regime doesn't have precedent for that, but who knows? Maybe they adapt to the market if they're not going to get somebody.
Yeah, I think it makes sense. All right, so we're getting close to an hour here. We're going to wrap it up, but I want to touch on two topics around the league before we do that. One is the Knicks trade for trading Porzingis for Dennis Smith Jr., salary relief, and just turning Knicks fans left and right into emotional wrecks. Let's talk about that from the Nets perspective. What are your thoughts, Brett?
So first of all, I just want to set the stage here and provide some context. I am not one of those Knicks-hating Nets fans because of the nature of the household that I grew up in. My dad roots for both teams. I never had hatred for any teams but the Boston teams. And so I'm not sitting here laughing. And in fact, I'm almost a little bit scared because even though, again, the Knicks management, James Dolan, hasn't shown any foresight in the past, it's hard for me to believe that you make a move like this without some inkling that something is coming in the future. And all the Nets fans that are laughing at the Knicks and pointing them out as a laughing stock and saying that the Nets are the best team in New York might be eating crow this summer when the Knicks get the number one pick, get Zion, and sign one or two superstar free agents.
Yeah, but I think you got to kick them while they're down a little bit, right? Like, well, I mean, here's my thought. I've thought about this a lot, since this trade happened. I honestly feel like the absolute best thing that could happen to the Nets would be for the Knicks and the Nets to be good at the same time. I think this whole idea that like, oh, the Knicks are just going to bumble away and like all their fans are going to like convert over to the Nets because the Knicks are too depressing, I think is unrealistic and stupid. I think you're much better off. Like, both teams are good. Nets could be a little bit of an underdog if they want to be. It mirrors the kind of Manhattan, Brooklyn, big brother, little brother dynamic pretty well. And like, just get some games that are just heavyweight fights where, you know, guys are just, you know, popping in haymakers, both sides back and forth, mixed crowds, like each way, Brooklyn chants, whatever the Knicks do, like the Vanilla Ice thing, you know, go New York, go New York, go. Like, I think that makes New York just a better basketball town. It's going to make more basketball fans. It's going to make people pay attention more. And I think it's going to be better overall.
Christmas Day, the battle for New York. This Christmas tree is lit. That would be awesome to watch.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. And then I think we would be remiss if we did not touch on Anthony Davis. And Brett, I have three questions for you.
Oh God.
So number one, let's talk about the most important thing of this saga, I think, in the vein of the melodrama or the Dwight Mare or my personal favorite, LeBronica. What is the nickname that we want to go with for the AD craziness? I've seen the Davis Station, the Browhaha. My personal favorite, I think, well, no, I have a few favorites. The Pelican Beef, Apocalypse Brow. Don't sleep on Apocalypse Brow.
That's good.
Or how about the one that seemed like it won on Twitter last night was Brauxit, which I think is funnier if you read it than if you say it.
The Brauxit, I do like that one. Off the top of my head, these aren't going to be good. Driving Miss Davis, maybe that's a good one.
That's all right.
We could throw that up. The Brauxit, I think, is very timely and topical. That might be the one that we have to go with.
I think so. I think that's the winner. All right. Number two. So obviously, you know, we've seen, you know, back and forth with the Lakers and what assets they're willing to throw in. So noted Laker parent, LeVar Ball, went on Phoenix radio last night to say that if the Lakers do trade for Anthony Davis and do not include LeVar Ball or Lonzo Ball, or maybe they do, I wasn't clear, his preferred destination would be the Suns, Lonzo's. Do you have any thoughts there?
I am very confused by the destination being the Suns, though I think it might be the perfect place for Lonzo because it's a no pressure environment for him to develop. And it's a place where he doesn't even have to have the ball in his hands on offense because they're running the point through Devin Booker right now. So I think from a basketball sense and a restart sense for Lonzo Ball, that does make sense. I don't know what the heck LeVar Ball is thinking when he says that. Maybe he just likes the weather in Phoenix and wants to be there. Who the heck knows? Maybe he's run some analytics and Big Baller Brand is sold the most shoes in Phoenix, Arizona than they have in any other major market in the U.S. Like beyond
two shoes.
Or maybe he thinks of the one organization that's dumb enough to sign the other Ball brothers to minimum contracts to appease Lonzo and potentially keep him there. There are a lot of things at play here.
So, but you have officially recalibrated your reality to account for that Ball bomb.
I was also thinking about the Brauxit too. It fits with all of the denied proposals.
It does.
When you think about that, next thing you hear, you're going to hear like Dell Demps is flying to Los Angeles to gain support for his latest Anthony Davis to the Lakers proposal.
Well, I mostly wanted to bring up the LeVar thing because, you know, I like calling it a ball bomb. And I think that, you know, if you and I get enough listeners, we'll be doing podcast ad reads for a product called Ball Bomb pretty soon, which I think will be like a scrotal chapstick that has an iOS app associated with it for some reason. So my third question about AD is just, what's going to happen?
I don't think it's going to happen. I think it's going to happen this summer. I think that they're well aware that the Celtics and other teams can offer a better platter of assets than the Lakers can. And I think that the Pelicans are ballsy enough and willing to sit AD for the rest of the season if they have to keep him healthy and make sure that he's a viable trade asset come this summer. I think there's potential that AD does not get traded, but they do get the type of package that they're looking for another player, whether it's Randall or Mirotić or Jrue Holiday. And quite frankly, as a Nets fan, I think Julius Randall is somebody that would thrive in our development-focused culture. But again, I think he's one of those players where we'd have to give up a little bit more than we're willing to give up right now for him, even though I think that we could see him flourish into a stretch four with the Nets and really raise that three-point percentage become a great passing big.
What do you think is more likely to happen before July 1st? Anthony Davis plays or Anthony Davis joins the Celtics. Anthony Davis joins the Lakers. Anthony Davis joins a team that is neither the Celtics nor the Lakers, or the Anthony Davis fires Rich Paul.
So Celtics, Lakers, the field, or kicking Rich Paul to the curb?
Yeah, which I think is it should actually be Lakers field or Celtics because he fired Rich Paul.
I didn't think about it that way, but that is very well put. It sounds like he wants to end up on the Lakers. I just don't think they're going to be able to put together a package that beats the Celtics. That being said, if the Lakers come back and offer four first-round picks, I don't care how many assets the Celtics throw at this thing, it's going to be very, very tough to beat that, regardless of where those four first-round picks lie, because they can take them and flip them into other assets if they need to. So I do ultimately feel like he's going to end up on the Lakers. Given that the Celtics weren't even listed as one of the teams that he would be willing to re-sign with, I believe it was the Clippers, the Knicks, Milwaukee, and the Lakers.
Yeah, I was bummed we didn't make that list.
Yeah, me too.
Even as a fake. But do you feel like the Pelicans are rational actors in this when it comes specifically to the Lakers?
Given the history with the Chris Paul trade and the way that LeBron and Rich Paul orchestrated this behind the scenes, it's very easy to see them not be. But at the same time, if somebody offers you a slew of young assets and four first-round picks, I don't care how emotional you are, it's very, very tough not to take that package.
That's true. Do you think that Rich Paul is acting in Anthony Davis's best interest at this point or purely in LeBron's?
Wow.
Because I'm sure that LeBron and Rich Paul have convinced Anthony Davis that it is in his best interest to go to the Lakers, and that's probably true. But, you know, if you're doing it to preserve your legacy, I feel like sitting out half a year is, you know, kind of a detriment.
Is that true? Because I think he would be better set up to win a championship in a place like Toronto or Boston, given what the Lakers will have to give up to get him. Because I think if you do that, you're really banking on a third star going to Los Angeles. And even if you have to eat into the luxury tax, that's what it's going to take, because all those young assets are going to be gone. You're not going to have much of a bench outside of buyout contracts, and veterans are going to try to ride LeBron and Davis to a ring. Now, I wish you would stop slandering this Lakers trade situation, because I really, really secretly want this to happen as a Nets fan, so we no longer are the franchise known for the worst trade in NBA history. I think if the Lakers give up this slew of young assets and four first round picks, this will eventually beat the Billy King trade, and we will be second best, and I will be ecstatic if that happens.
Well, I also think from a Nets perspective, I mean, AD's obviously already in the West, but if you create another power team in LA, and if that somehow causes Kyrie to leave, breaks up the Celtics, like, yeah, maybe he and KD join up with the Knicks, but, you know, that's two guys there without a ton of supporting cast around them. If Kawhi leaves Toronto, that kind of breaks down. So then you've got Milwaukee. You've got a weakened Celtics team. That's still okay, but I think more on our level, you might have a juggernaut in the Knicks, and you've got the Sixers, who I really don't know what to make of them. You know, I may eat my words if Joel Embiid rampages through the playoffs, but you know, I think they're really an enigma. You know, it opens things up a little bit to be the junior varsity East again, and you know, have a puncher shot.
I agree, and I will leave you with this. There was a Twitter thread that I saw the other day that said, make your craziest, wackiest prediction for the end of the NBA season right now. And one of the most popular tweets was Nets over Sixers in the playoffs in six.
I mean, I could see it. I mean, the game that Jimmy Butler won, the Nets were up 25, and then the Nets were up by a ton down in Philly like two games later, and, you know, had to hold on because that was, you know, back when we were in the habit of blowing leads every fourth quarter. But that matchup is not terrible for us.
We play them very well, and we might be fully healthy. I think we were up, like you said, I think we were up 25 at one point on them in one of the games that I watched.
I think they were up 25 in the fourth quarter, and then they, you know, blew that lead, which, you know, we were doing on a weekly, nightly basis. That is one thing. I mean, if Charlotte is trading for Marc Gasol, which I haven't checked where, they probably consummated at this point of the evening, you know, that's going to be a little bit more competition there for the fighting for the sixth through eighth spot. But, you know, that stretch where we blew all those games, it may come back to play a bit of a role in the seeding.
As will that Magic loss the other night. I will say I've been refreshing. I haven't seen anything happen yet. That being said, I can't wait for this podcast to be immediately and brutally outdated with all the stuff that happens tomorrow, specifically relating to the Nets. So looking forward to having to not air, cancel, and re-record our first podcast.
That's why we've actually continued it so long, as we're approaching 69 minutes, because we were like, hey, some news is going to break, or we want to be here for it. But since that's not going to happen, I think we should probably wrap it up.
I think so, too. I'll say this. Please, please, please feel free to tweet us feedback, suggestions. The goal is to make this podcast for Nets fans, by Nets fans. Carl and I are both diehards, regardless of when we started our tenure as Nets fans. Carl lived in Brooklyn, two blocks from the Barclays Center. As Jalen says, we want to give the people what they want. And if we do get enough questions and more than one listener, we will do a mailbag at some point. And I also want to give out a shout out to the OG Koskov Sucks, and a shout out to John Yoon, who's retiring this week.
One love. All right. Thanks, everybody.